This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of March 2018. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. How Austin's serial bombings revealed uncomfortable truths about racial divides in Austin.
If you have more than a passing knowledge of U.S. history, you understand that this resonates with a history of racial terror.
New city rules governing what can be built where could be put to a vote in November.
We believe they should have the right to decide whether this is the new land development code.
And why Texas wine is getting so much better.
We're actually having grapes that are being grown really well.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. For many residents of color in Austin, the recent series of bombings across the city amplified racial tensions and fears of racist attacks. Investigators say a recorded confession left by the bomber did not identify race as his motive. But as KUT's Saida Hassan reports, the attacks have left many communities of color feeling targeted.
In the days after the Austin bombings, Jesus Valles couldn't stop his thoughts from buzzing around like bees in his head.
Austin is an exhausting place where racism smiles at you and does yoga and is a kind teacher and is such a good actor and is just trying to help you and just wants to know why you're so upset and thinks we should wait to know.
Valles made sense of his feelings the best way he knew how. He sat down at his computer and began to write this public Facebook post about Austin.
And it is asking you to smile all the time, and it shops at Whole Foods and it loves trap, and if you don't like it here and if this city is such a problem, then why don't you just leave? And it is so exhausting, 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 and it is so exhausting.
Valles is a teacher by day. He's also a writer and a performer. His Facebook post has been liked by more than 8,000 users and shared by more than 4,000. The comments are filled with people saying things like, "You could be describing my city," or "I'm so sorry you feel this way." Valles says he's also been getting hateful responses from white supremacists. He says he was expecting that. But more than anything, his words have touched on certain truths for many Austin residents of color.
What's been fascinating is that the people who have been most viscerally responsive to it in a negative way have almost entirely been people who I think would see themselves as left-leaning or liberal. And I think it's because the idea is that a specific political orientation absolves you from racism, and that is not the case.
When we talk about Austin, there's a sort of shorthand that gets used a lot. It's weird. It's a progressive city. It's a blueberry in a sea of tomato soup. But Valles's words give shape to a sort of alternate reality that exists for many residents of color, and it made some people angry. There have been moments over the past month that have highlighted this racial divide. The first package bomb exploded on March 2nd, killing 39-year-old Anthony Stefan House, an African-American man. At the time, police were working with a theory that the attack was related to a drug raid they'd conducted at a house down the street. They also questioned whether House may have been in some way responsible for his own death, an idea that offended many residents of color. Austin Interim Police Chief Brian Manley later offered an explanation for those statements.
What we had was a singular event that had taken place in this community that was very unique. We had no information to believe that it was related to a larger plan at that time.
The first three package bombings all took place east of I-35, injuring and killing people of color. The attacker's approach changed with the fourth bombing. This one didn't appear to have a specific target. It was set off by a tripwire in a residential neighborhood in southwest Austin. The explosion injured two white men. Two more package bombs were shipped through FedEx facilities. Some observers took that change to say, look, these attacks aren't racist, they're random.
There's a sense that this really isn't part of who we are. This isn't really part of our history. And that comes across at times as a disavowal of history or a kind of evasion of historical truth.
Eric Tang is an associate professor of African American and Asian American studies at UT Austin. For years, Tang has been studying why many African American residents are leaving Austin, either by choice or because of financial pressures. He also looked at why some East Austin residents have chosen to stay.
And they stayed because they were resilient and they want to continue to hold on to that sense of community, despite having been segregated there to begin with, followed by rapid displacement of their communities owing to gentrification. And what they feel is that very few people in this city acknowledge that history. So this is the context, right, in which three package bombs go off in East Austin.
Tang says we shouldn't ignore why the attacks have felt like terror for many people of color.
For those who have more than just a passing sense of U.S. history, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear a bomb has gone off in a southern city? The first four victims were all people of color. Again, if you have more than a passing knowledge of U.S. history, you understand that this resonates with a history of racial terror.
And that feeling of terror didn't dissipate when the confessed bomber killed himself or when authorities said his recorded confession didn't identify race as a motive. About 20 miles north of downtown Austin, I met Sheldon Lamey in his neighborhood in Pflugerville. The 41-year-old is the president of Pflugerville Black Business Builders. Lamey was born and raised in Austin. He moved to Pflugerville about 11 years ago, drawn in part by a lower cost of living. Lamey also appreciates the community he's found in Pflugerville.
Better schools and also more black businesses I can patronize out here too as well. Don't get me wrong, I patronize all businesses, but I'm just saying just more community involvement, more cultural awareness and everything out here in Pflugerville.
In the wake of the bombings, Lamey says people feel unnerved, especially after learning the attacker lived in Pflugerville. He says the language used to talk about these attacks, in particular not officially labeling the bomber a terrorist, has been frustrating.
When you terrorize the whole city, it's no other word but to call terrorist, because everybody was scared. They, you know, I had one friend say that her son was scared to go to school, because he was scared that maybe a package bomb might show up to the school and everything. That was here in Pflugerville. So it was a terrorist act.
Lamey says he and other residents are trying to focus on keeping their community safe. They're banding together neighborhood watch groups and holding self-defense classes.
We can't take it for granted that this won't happen again. So we got to be proactive instead of reactive.
In central East Austin, Jane Rivera and her husband Gilbert have been trying to process some of the same feelings.
It appeared that these were very personal attacks directed to people's homes in communities of color. We're very outspoken in support of the community. Who knows, we might be next. And that's how all of us were feeling, very threatened.
The Riveras have owned their home in the Rosewood neighborhood since the 1980s. Gilbert Rivera is president of the local neighborhood association. He says the bombings no longer dominate their conversations, but the attacks have heightened another kind of pressure that's a constant part of their life in Austin.
Every single day, we get phone calls, we get letters in the mail, we get people knocking on our doors, telling us it is time for us to move out.
Rivera says having a bomber appear to target his community adds to the feeling of not being welcome in Austin. These days, he keeps coming back to the same question. Where will he go if he has to leave? Saida Hassan, KUT News.
This week, KUT hosted a community conversation about race in the wake of the bombings at the George Washington Carver Museum, and we broadcast it live on the air. You can listen back to that at KUT.org. At that event, the interim Austin Police Chief Ryan Manley characterized the Austin serial bomber as a domestic terrorist. Manley says he initially was reluctant to call the bomber's actions terrorism because of legal considerations.
Knowing that it might end up in a legal system at some point, I was being very specific on legal definitions that exist under federal law, because if this ended up being prosecuted, I was being very focused on the investigation. Over this past week, as I've reflected now that the investigation, although it continues, we've dealt with the suspect in this incident, I've had an opportunity to sit back and reflect on the impact that it had on our community and not be centered and focused on the investigation and try and put a stop to it. And when I look at what he did to our community, and as your police chief, I actually agree now that he was a domestic terrorist for what he did to us.
This weekend, a funeral is planned for Draylen Mason, the 17-year-old who was killed by the bomber. That's Saturday at 11 at Greater Mount Zion Baptist Church. But earlier this week, the East Austin College Prep School hosted a vigil to celebrate Draylen's life. KUT's Dalia Jones was there.
High winds and pouring rain. It may have seemed like the perfect scene for a remembrance after a tragic death, but the hundreds of students, staff, parents, and city officials packed into the school auditorium were there to celebrate life.
We have that family bond, so that's the best therapy you could ever have.
Ashley Sosa is a student at East Austin College Prep. She's one of the organizers of the Candlelight Vigil honoring Draylen William Mason's life. She says both students and staff worked on the vigil together as part of their healing process.
It really broke my heart, especially the way he passed away. Like, it's not something anybody should go through, you know.
School members shared videos and recited a poem. They read from Mason's college application essay. He'd been accepted to both the Butler School of Music at UT and the Oberlin Conservatory of Music. Some of Mason's friends even performed a dance tribute to a mix of his favorite songs while wearing pants they bought in Thailand during a school trip several years ago. Jasmine Lopez, who was a close friend of Mason, says it was part of an inside joke after Mason ripped his pants more than once.
I don't know how or what he was doing, but they would always be ripped, so he'd always go back and buy a new pair because they were so cheap, and I'm pretty sure towards the end of the trip, he had probably bought him like 20 pants or something.
There were plenty of stories like this. Like the time in second grade when he proposed to a few of his classmates with his mother's rings that she seemed to never be able to find. But Mason wasn't just known as a jokester or a hopeless romantic. He was determined, smart, and caring. Jacqueline Vidal teaches social studies at East Austin College Prep School. She says she met Mason when he was in the seventh grade, and he was one of the reasons she continued teaching.
One of the very few students my first semester here that asked questions about me, that wanted to get to know me, and that I developed a very special relationship with.
Vidal also says it's through Mason's peers that he's remembered and loved.
I know I'm supposed to be strong, and I know other teachers can kind of vouch for this, but it's the kids that are being strong.
His legacy will live on, and he will live in our hearts forever. Draylen on three. One, two, three.
Draylen Mason's funeral will be held this Saturday at Austin's Greater Mount Zion Baptist Church. Dalia Jones, KUT News.
Travis County does not have to wait to address racial disparities in maternal mortality. That's what a group of mothers, healthcare professionals, and policymakers said at Houston Tillotson University this week. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports on the measures they say Austin can take to stop more Black women from dying while pregnant or shortly after giving birth.
In Texas, Black women account for a small fraction of births, but make up about a third of the maternal deaths. Marsha Jones is with the AFIA Center. It's a nonprofit focusing on reproductive health for Black women. And she says Black women are dying regardless of their social status. She points to years of institutional racism and personal prejudice, saying it stacked the deck against Black women seeking medical care when they're pregnant.
My education and even my social circle won't buy me out of this. It won't get me out of this.
Jones spoke at a summit called Time to Stand Up for Black Mothers at Houston Tillotson Tuesday. She told the crowd that big changes are needed. She says these racial disparities are rooted in very old problems.
It's systemic. It's not going to be fixed Black woman to Black woman, Black man to Black man. It's not going to be fixed that way. We have to literally deconstruct the system that's been put up.
There was a large discussion about the scope of the problem facing Black mothers, but there was also talk about some of the things that could be done at a local level. Dr. Joya Creer Perry says she's worked with cities looking to tackle this issue.
There's actually a movement towards that. I'm working with the New York City Health Department, and they have put together a maternal mortality task force, and they have experts coming nationally, who I'm one of them, but they also have local folks, and they started with just counting the data.
Creer Perry says the city government collected data from local hospitals, asking for information about women who died during childbirth, as well as instances where women almost died. And that data helped the city come up with a game plan for how to change things. things. Keir Perry says it's easier to mobilize smaller communities as opposed to a giant state like Texas. And she says Austin is in a good position for taking this on.
And you have motivated individuals and motivated systems here who want to see improvement and want to see work happen. So it's now just building on that momentum and getting it going.
And she says a local approach would also make sure the city is addressing problems specific to this area. For example, Africa Farah with Austin's public health department pointed out that a lot of the Black community in Austin has been displaced and is now further away from some of the bigger healthcare providers. She says an approach to tackling racial disparities in maternal health outcomes should take into account that many Black mothers in this area are moving to more rural areas. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
A petition turned into the Austin City Clerk's office Thursday may mean voters have one more thing to consider at the polls this November. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey explains.
People hoisted four boxes onto a reception desk in City Hall yesterday. Right. The boxes were full of papers that were full of signatures.
32,000 of them.
More than I can carry.
City Clerk Jeanette Goodall took the boxes, and now she has to count the signatures.
I haven't looked at the petition, so I can't evaluate how long it will take.
Okay. To be valid, the petition needs at least 20,000 signatures from registered Austin voters. After that, the City Council will have a decision to make. Or not. But we'll get to that. First, what would voters be deciding on if this petition gets onto a ballot?
We believe they should have the right to decide whether this is the new land development code for the city of Austin or whether we continue under our old code.
Fred Lewis is a local attorney and part of a political action committee behind the petition. There's a reason this is happening now. The city's been working on a new land development code for the past several years at a cost of $8.5 million. It's called Code Next. And Lewis and others who filed this petition Tuesday have concerns about the new code. They worry increased housing density in parts of the city would negatively affect older neighborhoods with predominantly single-family homes and speed up gentrification in East Austin.
It's not a pro or con Code Next vote, despite what people say. This petition is not pro or con Code Next. It is pro-democracy. It is pro-public. It is pro little d grassroots democracy.
Those who support denser housing in Austin say it'll help with affordability by increasing the supply of homes and improve mobility by making it easier for people to live along streets with public transit. Regardless of where you stand, is this petition even legal? The city's outside lawyers say no, and a city spokesperson says the petition may be, quote, inconsistent with city and state law. Steve Adler is Austin's mayor.
If the intent was to actually come up with an ordinance that was consistent with state law, I don't know that the people who did this petition have actually presented something that works. But that's something that we need to take a look at.
The city clerk has 30 days to verify the petition. If council decides that it's illegal and they don't have to vote on it, Lewis has said he'll have to sue the city. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
The Austin Independent School District sold a former school and the land around it to the Alamo Draft House last fall. The local movie theater chain plans to use it for a new headquarters. KUT's Claire McInerney reports on what else could be developed on the Hyde Park property.
Alamo Draft House purchased the Baker Center, an old schoolhouse that AISD had been using for administrative offices, for $10 million. Along with a new home for the company's offices, the property will also include some housing. Architect Richard Weiss is working on the redesign. He says Alamo plans to use the historic school for the office space and build a new building on the back part of the lot.
When we build the building back there, everything above the ground floor can only be residential. So, we know we're going to build a building back there, and that locks in the residential component.
Weiss says the housing will be apartments or condo units. Putting housing on the property was something AISD wanted when they sold it, with the hope that some would be affordable housing for AISD teachers and families. Weiss said Alamo plans to make a quarter of any housing affordable, although the definition of affordable, just how much those units will cost, is still being worked out. That's something the city council discussed at a meeting last week. Councilmember Greg Kassar says this is a rare opportunity for the council because land in the city is scarce. He told the council he wants the price tag on that affordable housing to be as low as possible.
Seeing opportunities for public land to go by without the chance to bring economic and racial integration to those areas is just a missed opportunity, and I just want to not miss it while still achieving AISD and Alamo's goals.
Weiss said Alamo plans to seek a historic designation for the former school building. He said the company is committed to working with the neighborhood association to make sure the property serves the larger community as well.
Alamo is not looking at this project as a development project. They're looking at it as a project where they can be a steward for a building that's been there for 107 years, and they want to keep there as part of the fabric of the neighborhood.
The council will revisit the discussion around the property as it finalizes zoning. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
The weekend is here, and if you plan to have wine be a part of that, perhaps you could consider supporting producers located right here in Texas. From the hill country to the high plains, the selection of wines for this spring exemplifies improvements happening across Texas. Jessica Dupuy is a drinks columnist for Texas Monthly. It's great to have you back, Jessica.
Thanks so much, Nathan.
So what is the main reason for the increase in quality in Texas wines you're seeing for the spring?
I think the increase in quality has certainly been incremental over the years. One of the things that I'm noticing, and this might get a little bit geeky when it comes down to it.
But, let's geek out.
Let's geek out. Okay, good. The truth is, really great wine comes from really great places. And by places, I mean soils and site selections when it comes to vineyards. So what we're having is, instead of a lot of work having to be done in a wine cellar in terms of additions and subtractions to grape juice once it's fermenting and things like that, we're actually having grapes that are being grown really well. And I've noticed, particularly in the Hill Country, we've got some grape growers who are paying a lot more attention to things like canopy management, which in the vineyard means how much sun are you letting get to those grapes based on the leaves and foliage that provide shade to the grapes. That's just an example of little changes in terms of what is doing best for certain grapes based on the direction that they're planted with regards to the sun. There's a lot of little things like that that are starting to show up in the bottle in terms of taste and actual quality in the wine.
Something I've told people when I want to try and sound like I know what I'm talking about is something you told me, which is the varieties of grapes that are grown in Texas also better match the climate and the soil and everything?
Okay, yeah, that's actually a really big key. Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you look at Texas, whether you're in the High Plains, which is near Lubbock, right, or in the Hill Country, we have very different soils and microclimates than you would find, for instance, in Napa Valley in California. What's important is, yes, those grape growers and winemakers are selecting grapes that are much more suited for these warmer climates. So you're finding grapes that are more well known, for instance, in the Rhone Valley of France or parts of Italy that are warmer, parts of Spain that are warmer. And so those grapes are finding a really happy home here.
What are some of those grape varieties, just so I can throw them out in casual conversation?
Absolutely, yeah. So some of your Rhones would be Roussanne, Marsanne, Viognier in the white category, in red. That would be a Merlot, Grenache, Syrah. When it comes to Italian, you might hear things like Vermentino, Alianico, Trebbiano, Montepulciano. A lot of fun words to play with.
I like sound like they're fun to say.
Yeah. Yes. And then let's not forget Tempranillo. That's a grape that a lot of producers have banked on. And that's a Spanish variety that does really well as well.
All right, let's get to the top 30 Texas wines for the spring,
yes.
Your column in Texas Monthly. We don't have time to get through all of your top 30, but let's just throw out some whites and throw out some reds, starting with the whites, which you explained to me tend to be a little less expensive than the reds.
They can be, yes.
They can be.
I mean, yeah, and that's just a function of a lot of different things from the fact that red wines take a lot more oak treatment and things like that, which costs money. An oak barrel, a good oak barrel, can cost you $1,500 if you're wanting to age a red wine. So when you are dealing with white wines that don't have any oak whatsoever, then you're already in a better cost bracket. So that's just an example. But some of the white wines that were really great this year are some that kind of consistently show up in this list. Dukeman Family Winery, their Vermentino, their most recent release is a 2016 vintage, and it's just phenomenal. Crisp and bright, super fun, and just always a consistent crowd pleaser. And that wine is $18. And you can find that one pretty well distributed at like Whole Foods, HEBs, and then certainly at the winery as well. There's also Fall Creek Vineyards. They have a vintner selection, Sauvignon Blanc, that's a stainless steel, which means that it's seen no oak whatsoever. And so it has this nice, clean, super crisp, refreshing palate that's beautiful. That one is $22. And then one that I like to always bring up, this one seems to surface once a year, and it's Hack Vineyards. So they're based actually outside of Galveston. They have kind of had a lot of success with a grape called Blanc du Bois. And in particular, the dry Blanc du Bois that they submitted for this tasting is just really lovely. Super floral, a lot of tropical type of fruits on the palate and the nose. And it would go really great with kind of spicy foods. And that one goes for only about $19 as well.
For people like me, I'm used to spending less than $10 a bottle. What am I paying for in the additional price for these wines? I mean, obviously, I'm no sophisticated wine consumer. So tell me what I'm getting for the additional price.
Absolutely. So not that it's a bad thing to be frugal, but I will say that the old adage is correct, that you get what you pay for. Okay. So when you're willing to dig a little bit deeper in your wallet to pay for wines, you're getting things that are much more pure in terms of the actual wine that's presented in the glass. There are less additives to it, for instance. Another thing, especially when it comes to Texas wine, is compared to a place like California, Napa Valley, we have much fewer grapes in the ground. And so all these Texas wines that we are getting, we maybe have 5,000, 6,000 acres planted. And all of that hard work, a lot of it's being trucked down from the High Plains to wineries down here. So there's a lot of expense and a lot of meticulous work that's going into getting those wines into the glass. Compared to California, where you're looking at over 600,000 acres planted. We have a demand, which is great, but we also have to recognize that the quantity that we have is also in play here, too. So I think you're going to fall between $20 to $50 for some good Texas wines. And I think that that's a really good value, to be honest.
With that in mind, let's talk about some of your favorite Texas reds.
Yeah. So some that were super fun. One was a Tatum Cellars Mervet, and this comes from a winemaker who actually makes wine for William Chris Vineyards out in High Texas. His name is Josh Friche, and he does a couple of offshoot wines under his daughter's name, Tatum. This Mervet that he made is just stunning. It is big and bold and just this thick, heady, robust wine. Mervet does really well in Texas. It doesn't tend to be as big and robust as what we find in Bandol, but this one straddles that line really well. It's elegant and structured, but it also has a lot of finesse. So that was one of my favorite finds. That Tatum Cellars Mervet goes for about $50. So it's a little more expensive, but I think it's worth it. Another one that I thought was really a cool find is an unusual grape called the Norton grape. And this is from Stonehouse Vineyards. They regularly make this wine called Claros, and it is made 100% from Norton. And that's an American grape, actually. It's a native. It tends to be really jammy and thick and a grape that doesn't make, I would say, elegant, sophisticated wines in the examples I've seen previously. But Stonehouse does an amazing job with it. And so this is a big wine. It's got a lot of tannin. It's got a lot of fight to it. People that like their big Cabernets are going to really enjoy this wine. But there are just some unique characteristics to it, some different fruit flavors that I think people will enjoy. But this is definitely a big Texas wine.
What does that one go for?
That one's about $30.
That's just a taste of some of the top 30 Texas wines for spring, according to Texas Monthly Drinks columnist Jessica Dupuy, who tried about 150 wines to come up with this list. You can read about some of them in the April issue of Texas Monthly or check them out online at texasmonthly.com. It's great talking to you, Jessica.
Thanks for having me.
That is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of March 2018. Thank you for listening. This podcast is brought to you by the fine people who support local nonprofit journalism at KUT. We just wrapped up a spring membership drive, and we have a lot of new members, so thank you so much if you're one of those people. Feel free to share this podcast with other people. Just tell them to go to weekend.kut.org. If you have any questions or comments, email me, nathan@kut.org, or you can ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Have a wonderful weekend. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.
And then,